Good morning. It's Wednesday, the 5th of September. Welcome to the Roundtable. I'm Joe Donahue. So we were thinking about this, that as people were going to work this morning and they heard the theme, they probably drove off the road thinking they were an hour late for work.
That's funny.
Yeah. So, but no, you're fine. We're taking over the 8 o'clock hour so we can have our panel, and then we're going to go to the hearing, and we'll hit that. And we've got, but we just wanted to bring you in and talk about what's going on today. Let me introduce the panel to you. We'll get right to it. We have a lot of stuff to do this morning that we don't normally have to do, so we have to stay on schedule. I've been tasked, so here we go. Good morning, everyone. Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain is here. Good morning, Mike. How are you?
I'm great. Happy to be here, Joe.
Well, it's very nice to have you on the program. Jen Smith is here. She is a reporter for the Berkshire Eagle and joins us this morning, as she does most Wednesdays. And even though it still seems weird because of the holiday, it is a Wednesday.
And she looks remarkably refreshed, considering the fact that she must have been up all night with the Berkshire County District
Attorney.
It was
an exciting night in the Berkshires, for sure.
Cool. And you'll tell us a little bit about that, maybe?
You bet.
All right. Libby Post is here. She is a communications consultant. We welcome Libby. Good morning, Libby. Good to have you back.
Thank you.
And James Ketterer joins us, Dean of International Studies at Bard College. And what am I saying? Not director, co-director. What is it?
Academic director of the
Academic director of the Bard Globalization and International Affairs Program. I knew I was missing a word. James Ketterer is Dean of International Studies at Bard College and academic director of the Bard Globalization and International Affairs Program. Good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to have you here.
Nice to be here.
And Alan, good morning to you as well.
And thank you, Joe, for doing this and for making this happen. We were getting tons of telephone calls from people saying, "You can't not have the panel now of all times." So that's why we're here.
All right.
Now
so
early.
Here we are, and let's get going. We'll start with, of course, the Kavanaugh hearings and what happened yesterday. A lot of pushback from Democrats, a lot of good political theater, a lot of people arrested that were protesting in the gallery. And also, what was it, number 70, I think? So, Mike, do you remember? What was it, 70, something like that? 70-some people were arrested yesterday. And, well, guess what? We're going to do it again today. So we'll find out what happens. A lot of pushback from the Democrats who were most upset about a lack of timing in the documents that were released, a data dump that was done on Sunday night and not time to read that information, and also that there is a great blackout of information from Kavanaugh's time while he was serving in the White House, and that Democrats saying that that was key information that they would need. All of those attempts to end the hearing were of course, rejected. All right. Anybody want to start with thoughts on day one?
Well, what an extraordinary time. I'm so glad that we were able to play the hearings in their entirety yesterday, because it's what we do and what we should be doing. And I have to say that, you know, the theater of it was just fascinating. I said it was going to be boring yesterday, and turns out it was anything but boring. Democrats had a number of things they could have done. They could have stood up and walked out. They could have created, that, but they obviously duked it out in their own little conference, and they decided the way they were going to do it. In the end, he's got the votes. It's that simple. He has the votes. So what else can I tell you?
Well, I agree. They do have the votes, and I think the Republicans who are running the show have made a calculated decision that they'd rather have a little upheaval on September 4th and 5th and 6th and then seat Judge Kavanaugh so that he's in robes on the first Monday of October when the Supreme Court meets for their fall session. And by November, when the midterm elections happen, this will be but a faint memory, and there won't be much baggage from ramming this guy through in a Democratic process, not a bipartisan process, which is what you really want when you're picking a Supreme Court justice for life.
And I think those are the notes to take, right, about how this process went. And I think what will happen in hearings today is just to find out who's going to ask what questions, you know, what the responses will be, what the tones will be. And I think if anything, if, you know, there's plenty of information for analysts to take in, but for your American citizen, it's just to, you know, watch what's being said about the issues, because you know that they're going to be brought up. You know, I think those key issues that have Democrats have held against Kavanaugh all through this process are going to be brought up again in different ways by, you know, different senators, and I think that's really, if anything, what you can take home.
Yeah. Do you think that, how much of this do you think is tied in, Jen, or a panel, to the midterms?
I mean, it's
I'm not to interrupt, yeah. I mean, the midterms were brought up a couple of times in various statements made by senators on both sides of the importance of this.
And I think it will be something to consider, whether, you know, voters in those regions will take that into consideration. I think it depends. I think a lot of people at this point, their minds are pretty made up, unless something really outstanding comes out today. Maybe that'll change a vote. Anyone else?
Nah.
Well, it's going to come down to, you know, Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski and whether or not they feel that Kavanaugh stays true to what he has said, which is, well, at least what he said to Susan Collins, that he thought Roe v. Wade was a matter of settled law. And so I think, you know, I think that Susan Collins, I know she's getting an incredible amount of pressure from constituents in Maine and from all over the country.
Right. And I think that's what Blumenthal was kind of pushing at today, too, is that, you know, if you listen to his statements, he said, you know, the NPR reporter asked him, you know, what do you think? And he kept saying, well, it's about the American people. It's about, you know, the American people need to see this. The American people need to hear that. And it's again, about that messaging. And you know, if they can have any last minute sway at the polls.
Well, you know, I'm sorry, Jim, but I did hear White House's remarks yesterday. I don't know how many other people did, but it ought to be a book. It was the best thing about the Roberts Court and the development of the Roberts Court and where they have been positioning themselves. And I was incredibly affected by it. I don't know how much he had to do with the writing of that thing, but he delivered it well, and it was an incredible story of how the American people are being screwed.
Mm-hmm. And I think that these kinds of hearings, though they're happening before the midterms, and I think the midterms have a lot to do with the calculations on how each party is going at this. I think, you know, the drama at the beginning of the hearings and the yelling from the gallery and all of that is all calculated, and the response is calculated as well. But in a longer term sense, and Alan, this gets to your point, it's a time to think about the role of our institutions, time to think about the role, the changing nature of the courts. Libby, you mentioned that, you know, Kavanaugh has said that Roe v. Wade is settled law. I mean, Roberts said that as well. And it seems to me that the idea of overturning Roe is not likely, but eating away at it in the way that it has
Absolutely.
Is the much more likely outcome. So it can be settled law, but still be undermined.
Right, and it's been eaten away ever since 1973.
Right, and I think those are the sorts of things that will be difficult for the Democrats to get at without getting into the weeds of a lot of legalese. But I think this is the moment to do that.
But we know what the outcome is going to be. I mean, the outcome is going to be the guy is going to be confirmed. In the meantime, down the street, the most remarkable thing is going on. I mean, when you read, you know, what we have seen about what happens if a president goes crazy, and this president seems to be going crazy right now, the kinds of things that Woodward is saying, and apparently has tapes of all of this, about what people are saying in his own administration is incredible. So the idea that this guy is appointing the person who might be the final vote on whether or not, you know, whether or not you can indict, for example, a sitting president, and whether or not the truth that No person is above the law is existent. So it's really you got to tie these two of the three ring circus together.
Something that Patrick Leahy, Blumenthal, and Booker did this as well, Senators Blumenthal and Booker, but Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont made that point that, look, we don't know where this is leading, but it's probably leading to the Supreme Court. Kamala Harris said this as well, but what are we doing? We're putting someone now in who was the pick of the president who is going to be making a decision in this, and how much sense does this make?
Well, if he was honorable, he would recuse himself from any decisions that might relate to presidential authority or affect the president.
Meaning
that,
Kavanaugh.
Kavanaugh would, but he hasn't. You know, some people have called on him to do that, but it's been crickets. They don't have to do that. There's no requirement that they do that. He won't have to do that to win confirmation. He does have the votes. I think Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski will get some kind of bone thrown their way so they can vote for him and say, see, I was assured everything was okay, you know, and then he'll be sitting in October on the Supreme Court. And if any, in the future months, if anything comes up about presidential authority, he'll be there to debate it.
You know, somebody's spending millions of dollars on our televisions. To support Kavanaugh, and that is fascinating because one of the things they have a couple of attorney generals of different states stepping up to the microphone and saying, you know, this guy is an outstanding conservative jurist. At the same time, he's saying, I will study each thing, each of the decisions that are coming before me, each of the cases, and I will be independent. Well, that's a bunch of baloney, and we all know it.
You know, yesterday, I didn't get to listen to the whole thing, but Lynn did, and with great ardor, and she told me about...
So you got the spousal report
yes,
at
I
the
did.
End?
Okay. I did. It was very detailed. But about Ben Sasse, Senator Ben Sasse, and what he had to say about all of this. And he's a Republican from Nebraska, and basically saying that Congress has abdicated its responsibility for actually making law and looking to the Supreme Court to make the hard decisions all the time.
Interesting.
Because these folks don't want to have to go on the record of being pro-choice, not pro-choice, pro-gay rights, whatever the issue is, corporations being people.
Boy, there were a lot of snakes up there, weren't there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we were all in a big plane.
You know, yeah, there, the good point. You know, sometimes you forget, you get lulled, well, not lulled, but you get distracted from other things, and you forget just how disconcerting it is to watch Ted Cruz speak.
Hopefully it won't be much longer.
I think you can also see that the Democrats are still outraged at what happened in 2016.
Merrick Garland.
President Obama nominated Merrick Garland, right, who was a completely bipartisan, would have otherwise been a completely bipartisan candidate to throw before the Senate for approval, and probably in any other time would have gained approval. He was a moderate judge who had won support on both sides. They didn't even give him the courtesy of having a hearing. Mm-hmm. The leadership of the Senate, the Republican leadership of the Senate, didn't even take an audience with him. A couple of senators met privately with him, but it was so repugnant. And that was from February. And this happened over the summer, and we're already going to have the guy approved and sworn in the next couple of weeks. It's just to fast track this at such a crucial time and to delay that for more than 7 or 8 months is just unacceptable.
And yet the hypocrisy of the senators over the Republican senators over and over and over again of saying, how dare the Democrats say that they are against this man before he even gets a fair hearing.
And I think that's the legacy of this hearing and this process, right, is that, all this hypocrisy and all the things that are being said are all on record. And I think this hearing will and all the documentation of it will be a reference for future races and, who is saying what. There's a lot of presidential hopefuls among those testifying and asking questions. So I think that's all going to be brought up in the refrain when we look at how they act, just as we did with the Merrick Garland case.
But so, I think that this should not be the first time that we become aware that politicians can be hypocritical.
Well, no,
that's,
but it's
shocking.
It's a lovely reminder.
Yeah,
though.
But I think to Libby's point, you know, and what Senator Sasse was saying, that the power that does reside in the Congress to decide many of these things, that venue for hashing out political differences, you can't just circumvent that all the time and go to the courts. And on the Merrick Garland issue, on the Kavanaugh hearings, et cetera, you have to win elections. And if you don't win elections and you're outvoted, this is what happens. And I think this could and should refocus people on the midterms, refocus people on the importance of getting votes in the Congress in both houses. Otherwise, you're just outvoted.
Well, what do you think about?
I'm going to pause you there.
Sure.
And then you just when we come back, the first thing you say is, "What do you think about?" All right. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the roundtable. When we last left you, Jan Smith was about to say,
"What do you think about all the appointments that Trump has made in the district court level?" Though, before we talked about leaving the Supreme Court responsible for making legislation, but instead of Congress, like they should be, but. If any of these cases that could inform policy go to these district courts where he's already got plenty of appointees in, how does that play into all of this?
I would just say I find it incredible that they've been so efficient at appointing so many people in the courts. They've clearly been focusing on this because in other areas, like areas that I focus on, like diplomacy, they've been so slow in appointing ambassadors and have left many key posts open, but they've been very focused on the courts. I mean, there's clearly a priority.
I think it was the strategy all along, not from Trump, but from the Republicans in charge, to make sure that they got all of those appointees that they wouldn't do for Obama filled with conservative jurists so that they can impact the judiciary for generations.
Well, that was one of the reasons why Trump was elected. He won the support of the very conservatives and evangelicals by promising to basically hand over the responsibility of picking the judges to a very conservative group of lawyers and jurists who are setting the agenda. He took their list and said, "That's my list from whom I'm going to pick my judges," both the circuit court judges and the U.S. Supreme Court judges. And he's kind of out of the picture. They're controlling it. He has really nothing to do with it other than to, you know, sign his name on a piece of paper, if he can find it on his desk.
But he still has
or if he can find his pen.
But he still has to be the ultimate decision maker, Mike. And he still has to be the guy who goes along with it. We can't let him off because the Federalist Society is making the...
I'm not letting him off. Yeah. I'm saying do you think he knew anything about Brett Kavanaugh? Do you think he knows anything about these circuit courts? Court judges. He basically is told what to do.
Right.
He's already said he'll do whatever you tell me to this group.
Sure.
And they hand him the nominees and they've got the votes in the Senate and they just go in.
It's perfunctory. But I'm getting more and more convinced that these Republican senators, as all of those who are quoted in the book, the Woodward book, just hate his guts.
Mm-hmm.
But they are also aware that if they step out of line, they lose their offices because they get primaried and they're gonna get important. But they're willing to sell their souls for these judicial appointments.
So let's talk about the book, if we can, because we're going to have to go here soon.
What
so I want to make sure to get in as much as we possibly can. The book, of course, is a book called Fear. It is by Bob Woodward, who, of course, is known from Woodward and Bernstein fame regarding the bringing down President Nixon. And he has written a new book, as he has done for the past several presidencies, of looking at the first couple of months. It's usually the first 18 months that he looks at. He did this for President Bush. He did this for President Obama. And now he is doing it for President Trump. So the book will be out on the 11th, a week from yesterday. And not surprisingly, the Washington Post, who employs Bob Woodward, got the first copy of the book, and they reported on it. There's a lot of good juice there. There's some good stories. I don't know about you all. I read this and I thought to myself, well, that all seems about right. I don't know that there was anything that was incredibly. Surprising, although it is chilling when you realize that this really happened. There is a story in the book about John Dowd, who convinced the president would commit perjury if he talked to special counsel Robert Mueller. He staged a practice session to try to make the point. This was in January. The president stumbled, had many contradictions and lies until he eventually lost his cool, called it a GD hoax, and erupted at the start of a 30-minute rant that finished him saying, "I don't really want to testify." There's a lot of other good stuff in here as well if you're just looking for pieces of gossip, of things that various members of the cabinet said.
Kelly,
Kelly, Mattis, the list goes on and on. Jim Mattis said, "We're doing this in order to prevent World War III." This was at a National Security Council meeting. The talk about the basic line here is that it's a nervous breakdown of Trump's presidency, and Trump told Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, a wealthy investor 8 years his senior, "I don't trust you. I don't want you doing any more negotiations. You're past your prime." A near constant subject of withering presidential attacks was Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Trump told Porter that Sessions was a traitor for recusing himself from overseeing the Russia investigation. Woodward writes, mocking Sessions' accent, Trump added, "This guy is mentally retarded. He's that dumb senator. Oh, I'm sorry, dumb Southerner. My apologies. He couldn't even be a one-person country lawyer down in Alabama."
So take that, you Southern states who right. voted in unison for this president, as he mocks the South. You think anybody will change their vote based on that? I doubt it very much.
Well, they did get something for it. They got a Supreme Court. They got federal district court judges. They
sure.
got the president essentially allowing the Justice Department to undo a lot of civil rights policy and weaken policies that they didn't agree with. So people are sort of biting their lip and sort of closing their ears to the abrasive things that Trump says so they can get what they want. Did you hear mm-hmm. anything in this story that about Woodward's book that, one, surprises you, two, you probably already didn't hear already, and three, that you disbelieve?
No, you know what, Mike? We thought we knew about all of this.
Well,
we don't know it until somebody tells us that this is exactly the language that was being used. These are the people who said this. And that is extraordinarily scary.
The moment, too, that I have to say was, to Alan's point of being extraordinary, was that before he gets in while he's watching TV still in breakfast, the staff runs into his desk and starts taking papers away so he
doesn't just cancel our trade agreements
that's
with
right.
North, South
yes.
Korea or something like
well,
that.
Well, that's yeah. just scary.
Okay.
Yeah, I have to say that's the part that did surprise me. That's a sign that there's been a complete breakdown in process. That as administrations come and go into White House, processes tend to stay in place. There are people who know the processes, whatever the policies might be. And those sorts of breakdowns, I think, are really very serious and are being watched closely, not only in domestic politics, where people are trying to seek advantage, but by our adversaries around the world.
And our allies.
And the allies, who, of course, are very concerned.
Like the Canadians.
But if people are looking to find some advantage in you know, serious international issues, this is seems to be a chaos that lends itself to all sorts of openings.
So this is your specialty. Does it scare the hell out of you?
It does, because what I really worry about, where process matters, where allies matter, is in the midst of a crisis. What happens when, and something eventually will, when something really goes wrong? And then you don't have processes in place, you don't have the right people in place, you don't have the allies working from a level of trust. You can't just piece that together in a few minutes.
So if a Democrat,
it's got to be in place already.
So if a progressive Democrat gets elected who has your sensibilities about all of this the next time, how hard is it going to be to repair all of this? Not that hard, right?
I think some of it is easier to repair. You can put just the internal processes in the White House back in place. But for institutions like the State Department that have, you know, hemorrhaged people, you know, career Foreign Service officers who are there no matter who is president, people have resigned in droves. You know, it takes millions of dollars and years of training and experience to get people to a mid and upper level in the diplomatic corps. How do you replace them overnight? Mm. Bringing in a new group doesn't do it overnight.
Until the book comes out, here's some homework. If you get a chance and you haven't yet done it, listen to the tape between Bob Woodward and the president that was recorded on August 14th, 2018. The president is calling Bob Woodward, basically wanting to get in the book that has already been bound and published and it's on his way to bookstores. And saying that he knew nothing about it, and then saying, I knew about this, and it is the most bizarre, but again, not overly surprising, but
it reveals a level, even though you suspect something, when you're presented with this proof, it's just overwhelming. And the issue they're discussing, quite politely, I thought, was that I have tried to get to your people to get in to talk to you for this book, Mr. President. Woodward keeps saying that, and he says, well, it's too bad you didn't get in. Who'd you talk to? He goes, well, I spoke to Kellyanne Conway. We had lunch. Oh, Kellyanne's right here. Hi, Bob. You know, that kind of thing. It's just amazing. And they obviously, the book is about how people are shielding Trump from things so that he doesn't make bad decisions or sign documents that will do awful things. And manipulating him and not letting him know certain things. Well, obviously, the people around him did not want him talking to Woodward, and they protected him from that. And
by the way, your Kellyanne Conway impression is uncanny.
No, you've got to listen to it. It is exactly that way.
No, I know.
It's Kellyanne's. Kellyanne's right here, and she goes, "Hi, Bob."
It's true.
You know, it's just it's worth the 11 minutes of listening to it on the Washington Post site.
We're going
to
take a break. When we come back, Alan has letters. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to an early edition. The roundtable early edition. Yes, that's why. Is that why you're yawning? We got you up an hour early, Libby. I'm sorry. A little more coffee in the studio this morning.
The dog got me up an hour early.
Oh, of course. Well, we're on till 9, and then the hearings will go on. And so we want to get in as much as we can in the next 12 minutes. Alan has some letters, and then we'll see how many other topics we can get into.
Okay, so just wanted to read you, Joe, before we do that, a little bit of the 25th Amendment to the United States Constitution.
Oh, good. Read us that.
Which says, whenever the vice president and a majority of either the principal officers, meaning the cabinet, of the executive departments or any other such other body as Congress may by law provide, transmit the president pro tem of the Senate and the Speaker of the House represent their written declaration that the president, and then goes on to talk about unable to take their duties. At what point do you think Vice President Pence might agree to go along with
any day now? Whenever
okay.
he's called.
Yeah.
Here we go. Here we go on the letters. George says, Cav's absolute philosophy, one hates to bring up K's Catholic education, but that and the Kennedy era's notion of the imperial presidency seems to be, to me, to be at the root of an absolute philosophy, absolutist philosophy of law. I note he has said he will rule in terms of history, tradition, and precedent. Precedent last noticed. Sounds like a monarchical program, or like the church ruling as a government, as of course it once was, the Papal States, you know. And that's from George. Okay, and then Sydney says, has become, even Ross Dovnot has become concerned about the last 2 years. And Martin says, Kavanaugh, GOP calls to seat Kavanaugh before the October term make clear once again their transparent hypocrisy. They refuse to give Garland a hearing and let the court sit with only 8 justices for almost a year. If the Dems ever have an opportunity, they need to expand the court. People start talking about this. And yes, by the way, there's been a lot of mail to us about why can't the Congress just, when the Democrats get in, expand the number of people on the Supreme
right.
Court.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, they can, but there is this small precedent of Franklin D. Roosevelt trying to to do that.
Didn't go so well.
Yeah,
for
yeah.
Him.
Yeah. Yeah, that didn't.
History,
so, okay. So,
bite you in the ass. Well.
And so then there is Anthony who says, what are the rules? Panel, I watched yesterday, and I have to ask, what are the rules? The Democrats were politely asking for a delay, even broke out the rule, and it was denied by Grassley. It led me thinking that in the land of the law, there are no rules. Can someone explain? I'm beginning to think that democracy was just made up on the fly, and that's Anthony. If anybody wants to comment on any of this, just jump right in. Vincent says, the senator from Rhode Island was spot on when he cited 70-plus 5-4 decisions pushing the right-wing agenda. That's White House, and that's what I was
Sheldon
mentioning
White
before.
House, yeah.
The notion of a fair and impartial judiciary is a sham. And Ron says, Dems. So good for the Democrats to stand up at the beginning of the panel, but is there more they can do? It seems we are stuck in a cycle where the Dems are playing fair, following the rules, and preserving the democracy and order, but the other side has thrown the rules out the window. Do we stoop to their level? It's so frustrating. And that's from Aisha. And Norman says, why does Trump have standing to withhold papers of the Bush administration? Wouldn't Bush be the one with standing? I think that's true, and I think it is Bush who offered up what has been offered up. Is that correct?
Right, but I think under the law, these documents ordinarily would become public after so many years, and I think they're going to become public down the road. Good that it'll do
and
this issue, but
that's
you know.
The point of the contention is that, you know, well, if it's going to come out anyways, why are you withholding them now?
Right. Good point.
And Steve says, impeach Kavanaugh. If Kavanaugh wins appointment, could he be later impeached by a Democratic majority Congress for lying about his involvement in torture policy under George W. Bush? Well, certainly impeachment is an option. Very doubtful you're going to see it happen.
And he did say in his hearings for the circuit court that he had nothing to do with the torture policy, and it was later revealed that he was in meetings where the torture policy was discussed, and he specifically was asked in those meetings how Justice Kennedy, who Kavanaugh had clerked for, might react to the now infamous torture memo.
Mm. Interesting. And Richard says, Kavanaugh's nomination can go down. With the Senate virtually evenly divided, the GOP holding a majority by only one vote, the Kavanaugh nomination should be considered quite shaky. He's been nominated by perhaps the most thoroughly unpopular president in history, and his legal record has been marred ultra-partisanship. Would it be so hard to peel off just one GOP senator? Yes, it would be very hard.
Hard if not impossible.
Yes, it would. And Michael says, any Supreme Court nominees in recent memory with experience as White House staff? That constitutes gainful employment in a partisan political position, which I don't believe is appropriate for what is supposedly a nonpartisan lifetime appointment.
All right. We have about 5 minutes. I want to hit one other subject here because we have Jim here, and I know he has great expertise in this, so I'd like to talk to him about it. The U.S. Embassy bombing attempt in Cairo misfires. An apparent attempt to bomb the American Embassy in Cairo failed on Tuesday when an explosive detonated prematurely in the backpack of a would-be attacker, the Egyptian government said in a statement. No one was injured. It was the latest reminder of the continuing threat to Western interests from the simmering unrest in Egypt that began after a military takeover 5 years ago. The Egyptian military is still battling to extinguish a militant insurgency centered in North Sinai.
So I used to live and work in Egypt and was in that embassy all the time. It's one of the few U.S. embassies that's still in a downtown area. After the bombing of the U.S. embassies in Tanzania and in Nairobi in 1998, we moved most of our embassies out of downtowns. They're out in fields. They're surrounded by big fences. But this one is still in a downtown area. And U.S.-Egyptian relations on one level continue to kind of cook along. We send about almost $1.5 billion a year of military equipment to the Egyptian government. But on another level, they're really very fraught, and things are exceedingly difficult in Egypt. And I think this just kind of is a reminder. Egypt doesn't end up in the news very much anymore here in the U.S. It's a reminder that things are not all well. I think it's that kind of reminder. But it's also a reminder that we have diplomats around the world, and you know, while political theater is happening in Washington, people are going to work in embassies with targets on their backs, and it's up to
and know it and
do it willingly, and don't really get the credit for it that I think that they deserve. And oftentimes, particularly in consulates, which are in other cities outside of capitals, and in other kinds of installations, don't get the kind of security that they ought to get. We saw that in the killing of Ambassador Chris Stevens in Libya in 2012, and we've seen many other Foreign Service officers and other diplomatic personnel in danger. So, you know, the danger in this particular incident apparently wasn't that great, but I think it's an important reminder of all of those things.
Well, and meanwhile, today, while all of these hearings are going on, you have Mike Pompeo over and visiting Pakistan and in India this week, which are growing players in the world economy, and a lot of people are looking at them, from China to the ongoing relationship in Pakistan with the Saudis. So, as you squeeze the ambassadors, like those who work for years for the State Department, and then you have, an ambassador like Pompeo, who's new to this role and going over and trying to negotiate this seemingly as a one-man band, I think it raises a lot of interesting questions, too, and what that means for, while there are accusations from this administration saying these places are harboring terrorists and making inflammatory remarks like that.
So let me just ask Jim this question as our expert on the panel. What do you make of Pompeo?
Well, what I hear from friends and colleagues is that he's an improvement over Tillerson.
Yeah.
And I think that bar was set very low. Many people had said Rex Tillerson may have been the worst Secretary of State in the history of the nation, and certainly was awful at maintaining staff morale, staff support, etc. Pompeo is a West Point graduate, had been on the Hill, knows how government works, and has made some of the right moves, I think, in terms of just supporting the staff. And is out and about. The trip to the trip that you just mentioned, Jen, I think it's worth remembering these are both nuclear powers as well. And so I hear that it's an improvement.
And North Korea, of course, he got there early, right?
Right, even when he was at CIA.
We just have about 20 seconds.
Jim, I just have one other question. In your opinion, do you think that our colleagues across the globe, the diplomats from other countries, are playing the long game and just waiting for this blip to go?
May have to be a yes or no question, Jim. I got 7 seconds.
I knew you were going to say that.
We'll end there. We'll be back. The hearings right after this.